Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, we spend time looking at the development of two areas in Wilmington. Work on building up the city's riverfront has been going on for nearly 25 years and seems to be taking hold. We look at what's next along the banks of the Christina as that work continues. And on Wilmington's Market Street, World Cafe Live at the Queen turned 5 last week and sees a bright future for itself and that part of town.
I think we're close to hitting that tipping point. I think that we're very linked at the hip to Wilmington hitting the tipping point. We will do so together in the next 5 years.
We talk with World Cafe Live founder and president Hal Riehl. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine the Panama Papers and what they could mean to Delaware, and learn more about the drug that's helping a growing local biotech company. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Wilmington Riverfront has been a work in progress for almost 25 years now. The first piece of the development puzzle there, Frawley Stadium and the Wilmington Blue Rocks, are beginning their 24th year. And the quasi-public entity created by the state to manage development of the area along the Christina River, the Riverfront Development Corporation, turns 20 years old here in 2016. And while the riverfront seems to have found its footing in recent years, the bigger story may be, what's next there? Contributor Larry Nagengast took a look at that in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to talk a bit more about what he learned. As the Blue Rocks start their 24th season, the Riverfront Development Corporation turns 20 years old. The riverfront seems to have finally started to deliver on the potential many believed it had. But what's next in the process? What more can people expect to see on the Wilmington Riverfront?
Well, what's next? Let's talk about two things. The Buccini-Poland Group is about ready to break ground on the second phase of its Harlan Flats mid-rise residential luxury apartment building. And that construction there should get underway in a matter of weeks. And then later on this year, two more hotels will be coming. Again, Buccini-Poland is building them. And when they come up, we don't know exactly where they're going to be on the riverfront. Buccini-Poland says that they're still in some sensitive negotiations with the hotel sponsors. But that's going to give more people a reason to come down to the riverfront for conventions, meetings, and the like, and to stay. So it's another big addition right there.
I was going to say, both of those things kind of go to that point of creating kind of a critical mass, both in terms of residents who actually live there, and then obviously bringing people down on a regular basis year-round. And is that still something that everyone's talking about, is like, how do we continue to build that critical mass?
Well, I think they're at the point where they're feeling that the critical mass is almost there. When you add the second phase of the Harlan Flats and those units are occupied, you'll probably have 1,600-1,700 residents in the riverfront area. That is pretty significant. In terms of the hotels, having the one hotel that's there already, the Westin, that was certainly a plus. But the folks at the Chase Center say that you really need 2 to 3 hotels in the area in order to attract mid-sized conventions, the types of things that are going to stay here for 3 or 4 days and attract fairly large crowds. So I think we're going to say that the critical mass, by the time these projects are done, will have pretty much been achieved. There still be room for more, certainly, on the west side, but the critical mass is close to being there.
The biggest game changer, though, that could be on the horizon is a bridge connecting the west side, which has obviously been developed, to the underdeveloped east side. Tell us a little bit about this bridge plan and what its implications are for the riverfront moving forward.
Well, the bridge plan essentially would create a connector from Market Street, South Market Street, over into the developed west side of the river, connecting in the area closest to the Peterson Wildlife Refuge, beyond where the former shipyard shops, now which is now a series of office buildings, is located. When that is completed, and I believe it's in 2019, early 2019 is the anticipated completion date. Two things are going to happen. First, it's going to improve access to the west side, and particularly from people coming from the south and from the east. And in conjunction with that, it's going to make it a whole lot easier for folks who are at events at the Chase Center and at Frawley Stadium to get out on nights when there are traffic jams, when everybody is trying to get out along West Street and Justison Street. That's number one. Number two, it's going to literally pave the way for development on the long-neglected east side of the river, the area between Market Street and the river, where there are still some old industrial buildings and a lot of abandoned sites right now that the Riverfront Development Corporation is in the process of buying up.
Is there any initial indication or even kind of thoughts, concepts as to what might go on the east side of the riverfront?
It's fair to say that there is no single vision of what might be there, but I think you can look at an office complex, a series of office complexes, some residential development, probably another river walk that would on the east side of the river, similar to the one that's on the west, maybe a small piece of parkland that would have a picnic area and parking lot and the like. It's got whatever it is. Nobody's quite sure what it's going to be. Again, it's going to depend to some extent on who the developers are, whether they're large corporations, small corporations, whatever, who are interested in locating there, but it's certainly going to be compatible and have a similar look and feel to what's already on the west side.
But as we've learned, if we've learned anything from the last 20 years, what eventually happens on the east side may look very different than what we just talked about. People forget, I think, sometimes that what we see now on the west side of the riverfront is not what people had in mind 20 years ago, not even really 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, actually, if you go back 20 years, what was initially conceived was primarily developing on the east side and creating an area below the railroad station and along Market Street and along the east side of the river that would somewhat resemble Baltimore's Inner Harbor. Didn't happen. The development wound up coming on the west side, and even there was a large exhibition center that showed some blockbuster museum exhibits that lasted a couple of years, and then its popularity faded, and we wound up with the Chase Center. Kahunaville was a very popular nightclub, and that lost favor, and we wound up with the Delaware Children's Museum. The shipyard shops are designed to be a complex of outlets for catalog stores, never developed traction, in part because of the transportation access issues that we've talked about. And now that's essentially an office complex. So what we were looking at on the west side 20 years ago, even 15 years ago, is nothing at all like it is now. So what happens on the east side, we can't be sure. What the people are thinking about for developing in the next 4 or 5 years may or may not be what it looks like 20 years from now.
And I guess part of the reason why the east side concept gave way to the west side concept had to do with the first thing that came to the riverfront, and that was the Blue Rocks and Frawley Stadium. That was placed on the west side. It became the kind of remarkably consistent anchor for this area over really now a quarter of a century, nearly. How important has that been, Frawley, the Blue Rocks, as an anchor to make this thing work and give them the flexibility to kind of shift plans over the course of time to get to where we are now?
Well, I think certainly what happened with Frawley Stadium and with the phenomenal success that the Blue Rocks had at the start in the early 1990s was it gave people a reason to come down to the riverfront. I mean, this was an area that was abandoned. The Wilmington Public Works Yard had been the main attraction. It was really a pretty messy place to go to. And the Blue Rocks and Frawley Stadium gave people a reason to go there, and people came and they realized that they could be safe. The Chase Center with the original conception of it as an exhibition center brought more people down. The shipyard shops again brought people into the area, but not nearly enough to be sustainable. But the fact is, Frawley got it all started, and people gradually realized that they could come down to the riverfront and have a good time and feel safe. And everything else has very much built upon that.
Do you think it's fair to say that since the Blue Rocks were and are very family-oriented entertainment, that that helped kind of move the riverfront into that direction where you see things now like a movie theater, the Children's Museum, Stratosphere, that it wound up serving as the example of what would draw people there?
I think that's probably true to some extent. I wouldn't necessarily say that that's the only reason. If you're going to accommodate a broad demographic and have a successful venue, you do have to broaden your reach and make it attractive to many different types of people, many different age groups. But it is undeniable that the riverfront has become a more family-friendly destination. On top of that, besides the being family-friendly, is you have a solid core of nonprofit organizations on the riverfront that were there early and have stayed there and have continued to develop the Delaware Theater Company, the Delaware Center for Contemporary Arts, now known as the Delaware Contemporary, the Wilmington Youth Rowing Association, Opera Delaware. So you've got a lot of organizations down there that have made an investment in the riverfront. So you take the nonprofits, you take the family-oriented activities, and then you take the residential on top of that, and you know you've really got a very lively, vibrant part of the city that is really something that's quite enjoyable.
And even though the Rocks and Froy have been fairly consistent over the years, they are seeing some changes as well. What's going on there?
It's been probably 15 years since they've had any sort of major upgrade to the stadium. This year they've come in and they've put in all new seating, almost all new seating, 5,000 new seats and with backs, individual seats. There are only some of the old aluminum bench seats remain, and they're down the foul lines in the general admission area. So you've got better seating there. And then looking ahead, they are talking about even more improvements in the next year or two, hopefully developing a concourse that would run around the outfield with special activity areas for children and the like that would enable you to actually walk the entire circumference of the stadium, all 360 degrees of it, and be able to look in at the ball field and watch the game at the same time.
Our thanks to Delaware Public Media contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. Again, you can read Larry's piece on the Wilmington Riverfront right now at delawarepublic.org. Next on The Green, we check in with World Cafe Live at the Queen as it celebrates its fifth anniversary and discuss its role in revitalizing Wilmington's Market Street. This is Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A week ago, Wilmington's World Cafe Live at the Queen marked its fifth anniversary. When the live entertainment venue and restaurant opened its doors back in 2011, it was hailed as a game changer in the effort to revive Lower Market Street. Supporters hoped giving new life to the former movie theater that had stood vacant since 1959 would draw people and other businesses to that area. So how has the Queen and the area around it on Market fared over the intervening 5 years? Contributor Rob Kaless delved into that question in his piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he sat down recently with World Cafe Live founder and president Hal Real to get his take. Part one of their conversation focuses on the Queen itself.
Here it is. It's been 5 years since you guys opened doors at the Queen Theater. Just kind of take me through the last 5 years.
I think what's most exciting is when you think 5 years ago what the state of the world was, we were just at the beginnings in the throes of the worst recession. The worst economy since the Great Depression. And, of course, for 30 years prior to that, people had been skeptical with all of the talk about Wilmington revitalizing and coming back, and there were a lot of naysayers. And we were recruited to be the catalyst to help turn that around. And I think, we were all feeling pretty negative during the recession anyway, and there were a lot of people, a lot of those naysayers saying this will never work and never happen. So it's very gratifying to have given that, to have survived the first 5 years and to look forward to thriving in the next 5 years, because I really do think that Wilmington is maybe not quite at the tipping point, but very much on the verge. And it's no more a discussion about someday Wilmington will revitalize. It's going on right now as we speak all around us. And we're thrilled to have played this catalyst role.
Looking back on key milestones, successes, you know, community partnerships, all the shows you've done here, just what are some of the highlights that you think back on from the past 5 years?
Oh, I mean, there's so many highlights. I guess one highlight for us every year in February is we have an event called Shine a Light. And the Shine a Light is when, well, let me go back 5 years. When we opened in Wilmington, the local music community knew that at the heart of World Cafe Live, we like to be a clubhouse for the arts and music community. And so the local music community, many members came to me and said, well, we can't write a check to contribute $10,000 towards this great project, but we can play. What can we do to help? And we said, well, let's put a night together where we get 50 or 60 Delaware musicians, Brandywine Valley musicians, together, but not doing your band, rather forming, taking a night and playing with, you know, deciding what the theme will be for that night and having the lead vocalist from band X with the lead guitarist from band Y. And a lot of musicians who thought they were in competition all these years suddenly became buddies, and it turned into the great anti-gala event of the year that sells out every February. And not only, I mean, its primary purpose is to raise $100,000 for programs that the Light Up the Queen Foundation does, in particular bringing kids in for all kinds of great programming here at World Cafe Live at the Queen. But in addition to that wonderful, you know, to the fact that it's raised over $300,000 in the first 5 years, it's just this great community feeling when you have all of these musicians and all of their fans rocking the place out in celebration of turning what was a symbol of the urban blight of Wilmington since 1959, and we've turned it into this sort of beacon of hope. And that's the night that everybody gets together to celebrate. So that's an annual highlight. Other highlights, I guess, might seem strange to some people, but I guess I have my own way of measuring our success. So while it's wonderful to have sold-out shows for well-known artists like Lindsey Buckingham and Grace Potter and John Anderson and Raul Malo, for me, one of the real highlights is to see that the artist and agent community and our fans are starting to understand what World Cafe Live is about and getting great crowds for up-and-coming artists like Chris Stapleton. You know, Chris Stapleton was here on a weeknight in August last year, and very few people knew who he was, and now he's just won about every award he's been nominated for in the past year. And it's kind of like what happened in Philly when we had Adele four times before anybody knew who she was. And that's really what World Cafe Live is about, is not only presenting the known heritage artists we present, but also presenting the up-and-coming artists and sometimes being well ahead of the curve on that. So those are real highlights for us, those kinds of shows, too.
So obviously one of Wilmington's greatest challenges over the last decade or so has been this commitment to getting people to come downtown, to live downtown, to play downtown, to stay downtown. And, you know, I know that's a challenge, and you guys are fighting that challenge, and it seems like you're winning that challenge, winning that battle to get people to come down here and stay down here and realize what Market Street has. What do you say to people who maybe are still wary about coming downtown, but at the same time don't realize exactly what's going on here, how much vitality there is on Market?
Right. I say come on downtown. I really think that I understand perception can become reality, but the perception that Market Street is not safe or is any less safe than any similar street in any city in America is really a misperception. Yes, you know, there can be incidents, there can be hassles, as I said, like in any city, but in my experience in these 5 years living and working on Market Street, it's very safe and it's a very welcoming place. We have parking right next door and so forth. One of the ways that we have overcome this, and one of the ways we've helped introduce people to World Cafe Live of the Queen, are all the wonderful events we have. So, you know, a lot of people, we're a confusing concept. We're three things. We're music, we're a restaurant, and we're also events. And events are a big way that people learn about World Cafe Live. And when I say events, I mean, weddings and bar mitzvahs. And so somebody who is a little wary of coming to Market Street gets invited to a wedding at World Cafe Live at the Queen, they sort of have to come. And what we find out is when they come, they say, wow, parking is next door for $5. It was really, I felt very safe. And the place is so cool, I'll come back for music, I'll come back for food. And so in a lot of ways, events is sort of our Trojan horse of getting people back on Market Street, because we've done, you know, over 1,000 events in these first 5 years. And I mentioned some social events, but everything from Senator Carper's 65th birthday party to Governor Markell signing the civil union legislation to fundraisers for Nemours Children's Hospital and the Chambers of Commerce and almost every charitable organization you can think of, all of those and big business workshops and business functions, all of those things go on in this building. And I do think that that's helping knock down the misconceptions and the barriers, because as I said, when you're invited to an event like that, you come and you say, this is a cool place, I'll come back.
That's World Cafe Live's Hal Real with contributor Rob Kaless. We'll hear more of their conversation in just a moment, looking at how the area around Market Streets has grown over the past 5 years. But first, your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm Tom Byrne. Last segment, we heard the first part of contributor Rob Kaless's interview with World Cafe Live founder and president Hal Real about World Cafe Live at the Queen and its 5th anniversary. That conversation continues now with the focus shifting to the growth of Lower Market Street around the Queen during its first 5 years in business and what the future holds.
Speaking of business on Market, since you've been here, what are some of the new neighbors that you've seen pop up on Market, specifically in the 2nd to 6th Street area, which for a lot of years was kind of, and I've talked to local people who have said it was kind of a dead zone before the Queen came along. It was kind of, there was a disconnect between Lower and the northern end of Market. Have you seen anything in particular? And we talked a little bit about, you know, places like Lafayette and so forth. But what are some of the places that you've seen pop up that you maybe don't want to take credit for, but look at and say, wow, you know, that's something that wasn't here. Maybe we'd never even imagine them being our neighbors, but maybe because of some of the work we've done here, that's why these people are coming to establish businesses downtown.
Sure. I think, first of all, we'll see a lot more of that in the next 5 years. But in these first 5 years, I think, and really in the last year or two, you're starting to see this accelerate. And this is what I mean about Market Street hitting the tipping point. So, you know, it started out with Brian and Andrea Sikora doing Lafayette, and now they've opened two more places in a block. And we're thrilled. People will say to us, well, isn't that competition? We're like, we love it. Fine dining and fun dining. And we love having neighbors, and we love that the new Merchants Bar is busy when we have a big show night before our shows and after our shows. And we're busy, too. It's great. There's room for more. And people need, we don't want to be a solo destination. We're glad to be an anchor, but we would love to be one of many. I think, in addition, you see places like Loma Coffee and the Archer Groups and some of the businesses on the lower end of Market Street growing and thriving. But most importantly, for retail to come around, and it's the last sector to recover, always from a recession like this, but you need to see more people living on Market Street. And that's the most exciting development of the last few years, is that we see a constant now flow of spaces around us being rehabbed on Market Street, and now starting to see some of the numbered streets and some of the other streets in Shipley and other places. We see Wilmington Renaissance starting the creative district with lots of new interest from national funders and other cities looking, saying, wow, this has real potential to become an arts district. So it's sort of that kind of groundswell in multiple places. And again, more residential units on Market Street. And I don't mean a dozen like when we opened, I mean hundreds. And as far as we can tell, as soon as these apartments are rehabbed, they're leasing up rather quickly. People want to live on Market Street. The more people who want to live on Market Street, the more merchants will want to be here with businesses on Market Street. And I think 5 years from now, we'll look back and say, where are all those vacancies that used to be on Market Street? It's really hard to get a space. And it'll be like we think of Westchester now and Manayunk and Media and other places with its own particularly unique characteristic. Wilmington's got tremendous architectural characteristics, tremendous transportation opportunities. Half of our tickets are sold to people who are not even from Delaware. because it's so easy to get in and out of Wilmington. So we've got people coming to our concerts from the Main Line, from Chester County, from downtown Philly, Jersey, Maryland, Lancaster, because it really is a great location.
In the next 5 years, as more businesses move in, retail, and there are more people living down here, residential, what do you see as maybe some of the challenges or things that need to take place to facilitate that? Parking garages, security, or any kind of other institutions that you think, you know, we really need something that, you know, every community has, right, that maybe market doesn't have yet but could use in the next 5 years?
I hope we see a lot of homegrown and really, you know, sort of Delaware-centric and local businesses and boutique kinds of things so that it retains the unique characteristic it has. And, I should have mentioned that part of the other big change on Market Street, especially where we are, is Market Street has a mind and a heart. And by that, I mean we've got terrific neighbors at DCAD, which is growing like crazy, the Delaware College of Art and Design. We have amazing neighbors at the Delaware Historical Society who have raised millions of dollars and are completely revamping the museum next to us in the old Woolworths, which will be the first one to really focus on African-American history here in Delaware. Very exciting. They've done a beautiful job with the new addition to the building and with rehabbing the old Wilmington Town Square and Town Hall. And that's just a great amenity for the community. We've got Christina Cultural Center right up the street from us. And, of course, the Grand and the Playhouse. So we've got a heart and a mind on Market Street that's pretty vibrant, especially for a city this size to have those assets within a few blocks of each other. I also think that one of the trends that's important is to see more things that attract millennials and in general, the new workers for the new age. So we're excited that there's 1313 Innovation at Hercules. There's the mill opening at Nemours. So we've got these shared workspaces, and we've got the kind of place that people who are in their 20s and 30s and spinning off their own new companies want to come. Now we need places where they want to hang out. World Cafe Live at the Queen is just one of them. We'd love to see another half dozen open up on Market Street during these next 5 years. I think we're close to hitting that tipping point. I think that we're very linked at the hip to Wilmington hitting the tipping point. We will do so together in the next 5 years. But, I think we're both making great progress, but we still have a little ways to go. You know, but when I look back at where we started in Philly, it wasn't dissimilar. It was a very scary location, and now it's booming. And I think Wilmington will look very different. It looks very different now physically, and it feels different spiritually than it did 5 years ago. I think it'll be very much changed, even more so, 5 years from now.
That was World Cafe Live's Hal Rio with contributor Rob Coless. You can read Rob's full story about the Queen's fifth anniversary right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Political reporter James Dawson joins us with an interview explaining how the recent Panama Papers leak could have an impact here in the First State. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. World leaders, celebrities, and sports stars have been linked to shadowy offshore shell companies in a leak of more than 11.5 million documents known as the Panama Papers. But the Panamanian law firm that originally held the documents is far from alone in allowing those who pay a registration fee to stay secret, or sometimes launder billions of dollars in private. Delaware is among the top incorporation states in the country, needing little more than the name of a manager and an address to send any paperwork to register a business. Delaware Public Media's James Dawson spoke with Tom Cardamone, Managing Director of Global Financial Integrity, about what implications this leak has, both locally and internationally.
Could you start off with kind of describing what the Panama Papers leak is and really its significance?
Yeah, the scandal reveals the enormity of the shadow financial system around the globe. Mossack Fonseca is a firm in Panama and with dozens of other locations around the world that helps individuals and companies establish essentially shell corporations that are completely anonymous that enable people to launder money and avoid taxes. This is by far the most enormous release of documents in this area ever. Over 11 million documents. Over 200,000 firms have been created. Some 14,000 clients. It's just an immense amount of information, and it surrounds the globe as far as countries that are involved. Over 200 countries are involved.
To what extent is this industry thriving around the globe? Do you think this is maybe just, not to be cliche, but a drop in the bucket, you know, versus, you know, getting a significant amount of this out there in the public?
I have a fear that this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we're talking about one firm doing this. How many other scores or hundreds of firms are doing something similar, maybe not to the same degree, the same volume, maybe not in as many countries. But the fact of the matter is jurisdictions, countries around the world with very high levels of opacity, meaning very high levels of secrecy in the financial system, there are many, many, many of those. And so if it's not Panama, it could be the Caymans or the British Virgin Islands or Singapore or Luxembourg or Nevada or Delaware. It could be in many, many jurisdictions around the world. So we don't know what we don't know. Be very difficult to say for sure, but I think this may be just a little bit of what's potentially out there.
And you touched on this a little bit earlier, but really, what are people trying to get out of creating these shell companies to really make them anonymous in regard to their assets?
Well, you said it. They're trying to be anonymous. They're trying to hide behind a corporate veil. They hide behind incorporation firms such as this one and many others like it, so that if the tax authority or law enforcement happens for some other reason, become aware of money held offshore, they can't be tied to it because there's no, as the phrase is used in the field, there's no beneficial owner that's apparent on any of these incorporation documents. The actual flesh and blood person who controls the account is not known to anyone other than the firm that creates the company itself, and they have attorney-client privilege, and the firm does not have to release that information.
I'm obviously in Delaware. We're a huge corporate haven, really, in this tiny state with just a little under a million people. If you take into account just the corporate franchise and LLC taxes and business entity fees for the current fiscal year, I mean, this is making up a quarter of our budget. If you do create some sort of new oversights, won't that have an effect on these people, these 940-some-odd thousand people?
Well, what the effect it will have is that they no longer have complete anonymity. They have privacy. Their bank accounts aren't known or anything like that. But if for some reason law enforcement or the IRS, in the case of Americans, needs to get in touch with them, they have that ability to do so. There's nothing illegal with creating an LLC, onshore or offshore, in Delaware or in Panama. There's nothing wrong with that, and we're not suggesting that that should be stopped. What we're saying is the people who create the LLC or the trust or whatever other mechanism they may create, they have to be known somehow to public authorities. That's all we're talking about.
So specifically, you just want to almost have kind of a point of reference to be able to contact these people, a point person?
Not just a point person, because what exists now is a point person. These incorporation companies, like Mossack Fonseca, are the point person. What we're saying is that it has to go beyond just the point person. It has to go to the very person who controls the account. Whose money is it? It has to be that person's name on the incorporation documents.
Does it have to be really done at the national level? Because I mean, I'm the state political reporter here, and I can tell you that all 62 of our legislators, one of the top things on their mind is making sure that the state is business friendly and having these sorts of maybe by some standards lax laws in place so that they can attract all these businesses here to get that kind of revenue.
There has been legislation introduced in Congress, I believe every year for the last 4 years, that would require on a national basis, states would have to implement it, but a national requirement that any new LLC would have to have its beneficial owner listed on the application. Now, what that means is if I wanted to set up an LLC, and my original thinking was that I would do it in Delaware, but now because of the national law, Delaware would require my name. I cannot go to Florida or Nevada or any place else because the law would be nationwide. So Delaware itself would not lose the business because of me going to some other state. It would still be considered business friendly. It would just require the name of the owner of the firm. Now, what it may do is it may prevent money laundering due to, you know, numerous types of crimes, drug trading, arms trading, terrorist financing, people who would move money around for terrorist financing purposes. It may prevent them from creating an LLC in Delaware or anywhere else in the United States. But at the end of the day, are those the types of firms and those the types of people that Delaware in other states would actually want to be doing business with? I don't think so.
How far has this ever gotten in Congress? Has it even gotten past the committee level?
Unfortunately, it hasn't. You know, what we're hoping is that, you know, once the American names related to this scandal are released, and as we understand it, that's going to happen in the coming days because there's no U.S. Names have been mentioned in media thus far. Hopefully when that happens, it will renew the push for this in Washington. And I think what may push this down the road a little bit is an understanding that this is more than just the bold-faced name, so to speak, more than just the film executive or the premier professional athlete who may have these accounts offshore. You know, it may be the dentist down the block or the restaurateur who you went to high school with. This may be far more broad throughout the community, and people may begin to realize, well, you know, Joe down the road isn't paying his taxes like I am. He's got his money hid offshore. We may have a whole different conversation about this in the coming weeks and months.
And what happens if it just remains business as usual?
Well, we're going to see more money laundering. We're going to see more tax evasion. And it's far easier to for terrorist cells to move money around the globe completely anonymously. I mean, if that's the type of government oversight people are comfortable with, that's unfortunate, I think. I think there's I think what this shows is there's a fairly complete breakdown in global governance. This is, you know, worldwide. It's systemic. The numbers are staggering. The dollar figures are staggering. To understand the magnitude of the problem and then to do nothing, I think would be the bigger crime.
Our thanks to Global Financial Integrity's Tom Cardamone and our James Dawson for their time this week. And stick around. This week's Enlighten Me is next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. The Wilmington-based biotech corporation Insight is expanding. Late last year, the company announced it would be growing its base in northern Delaware, potentially bringing more employees to the state. And it's also making plans to open its European headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland. Much of the company's success is linked to strong sales of its cancer drug Jakafi, the only FDA-approved drug to treat two rare blood diseases. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Eli Chen spoke with Insight's Chief Scientific Officer, Reid Huber, about how the drug came to be and the new directions the company is taking the research.
So Dr. Huber, just to start off, tell me a little bit about Jakafi's origin story. How did research in the last decade support the development of this drug?
So Jakafi blocks the activity of two important enzymes in the body. These enzymes are called Janus activated kinase 1 and Janus activated kinase 2. We call them JAKs for short, so JAK1 and JAK2. And these two enzymes play important roles in the body by allowing cells to respond to certain external stimuli, including those relating to inflammation and cell growth and cell division. We had started a drug discovery program against JAK1 and JAK2 in 2003 with the belief that a product may have an ultimate utility in patients both with cancer and in certain inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. In 2005, just a few years after we started working on Jakafi in the lab, it was discovered that a hyperactive JAK2 enzyme was the root cause of a number of rare bone marrow cancers, which are collectively referred to as myeloproliferative neoplasms. Because a hyperactive JAK2 was causing these cancers, we reasoned that treatment with Jakafi, by virtue of its ability to block both JAK1 and JAK2, would benefit these patients. And so we set out to evaluate that through a series of clinical trials. Those studies subsequently proved that the hypothesis that we had way back in 2005 was in fact correct. And in 2011, Jakafi was approved for the treatment of intermediate and high-risk myelofibrosis, or MF, the most severe of the myeloproliferative neoplasms. And a few years later, in 2014, Jakafi was also approved for the treatment of a second myeloproliferative neoplasm called polycythemia vera, or PV, and in specifically in patients with PV who had failed to be controlled by a commonly used chemotherapy called hydroxyurea. So importantly, for the first time, you now have a therapy in Jakafi that's approved to treat these two diseases, and patients with these rare blood cancers now have a treatment option that they and their physician can consider for their use.
Along with those two blood cancers that you mentioned, the company plans to test Jakafi as a treatment for graft versus host disease. What is this disease and what's the drug's approach to treating it?
So in graft versus host disease, we understand that inflammation and certain aspects of the immune system have gone awry. You know, your normal function of your immune system is to help identify pathogens, whether they're viruses or bacteria or the like, anything that is not self, and eradicate those. In the stem cell transplants that are commonly used as curative treatments in certain bone marrow cancers, you're giving patient through a transplant stem cells from another person. And so as you can appreciate, those cells can often view the recipient as non-self. They're functioning as they normally should, and can create a very debilitating and deadly immune reaction within the patient's solid organs, including their GI tract, their skin, their liver, et cetera. And this can cause serious, very severe complications. And so by inhibiting the JAK1 and JAK2 enzymes, a drug like Jakafi, we think, is altering that immune system response to a non-self situation in the patient and actually reducing the inflammatory insult and ultimately giving rise to benefit. This has been explored in the study published in Leukemia by a group of investigators around the world last year, but it hasn't definitively been studied until you get in the phase 3 setting. And that's a study that we plan on doing to determine unequivocally whether we are, in fact, able to bring benefit to patients with disease.
Tell me more about why the ability to treat graft versus host disease is so significant.
Well, you know, in graft versus host disease, your first available treatment for patients is steroids. And steroids can be active in many patients with graft versus host disease, and they will, for the foreseeable future, continue to be an important part of the treatment regimen. However, in those patients who don't respond adequately to steroid use, this is a high unmet need, and these patients have often dismal outcomes with shortened survival and incredibly complicated clinical courses. So to have any treatment available that can address the important unmet need there would be a significant advance for medicine and specifically for the use of transplant and bone marrow cancer. So we're very excited by the opportunity now to take Jakafi into those patient populations.
And earlier this year, your company canceled clinical trials to test Jakafi as a treatment for solid tumors like lung or pancreatic cancer. Could you describe for me some of the initial data that seemed to suggest that this was possible?
So because the role that the JAK1 and JAK2 enzymes can play in certain blood cancers, we and others in the scientific and medical community became very interested in the therapeutic potential of a drug like Jakafi in certain solid organ tumors, like pancreatic cancer and colorectal cancer, for example. These obviously are very different disorders from the blood cancers where Jakafi is approved and used. And we had, in fact, a small phase 2 trial to study Jakafi in advanced metastatic pancreatic cancer patients. And we observed that the drug did have the potential for beneficial activity. And that activity in that trial appeared to be limited to a particular subgroup of patients who had a sign of elevated inflammation in their blood. And those data gave us the provocative hypothesis that that elevated inflammation may allow us to select for a specific patient population with solid tumors who may be more likely to respond and benefit from Jakafi. So we initiated a number of clinical trials to formally test that hypothesis, including a phase 3 trial in pancreatic cancer. As we reported, unfortunately, those results did not prove the hypothesis to be positive, and we can actually be quite certain now that inflammation in the blood does not necessarily predict a unique sensitivity to Jakafi. These sorts of negative outcomes are, of course, fundamental to the research process. And while they're always disappointing, they clearly enable us to learn more about the therapies we're discovering and the patients that we ultimately wish to help. And we continue to evaluate Jakafi in other groups of patients, both with blood cancers and with solid organ tumors, to try to identify other patients in whom Jakafi may be able to provide benefit.
Our thanks to Eli Chen and Insight's Chief Scientific Officer Reid Huber for enlightening us about the drug Jakafi this week. And that's all for The Green this week. Remember, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We also want to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors Rob Kaless and Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Eli Chen and James Dawson, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.